Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. We're inspiring conversations for the unafraid. I'm Janice McDonald, founder of the Beacon Agency, author, and global champion for women. Why am I making this show? Because I want to share the inspiring stories of women leaders in business, arts and culture, politics, and more with all of you. Hear how they've chosen to go forward and be bold and make the world a better place, even when it wasn't easy to do. Subscribe now wherever you find podcasts. Hey, everybody, I'm Janice McDonald. Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. I'm delighted to welcome JP Gladue to the show today. JP is the president and CEO of the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business, which is based in Toronto. He has many accomplishments and a long list of credentials, including serving on the board of Ontario Power Generation and numerous other boards. I'm very excited to get your perspective and insights. Welcome to the show, JP.
Thanks, Janice, for having me.
And thank you and welcome to our listeners from around the world, including USA, UK, Spain, Mexico, and so many more countries. We want our community to grow, so please tell your friends and follow us on Instagram. Thanks also to our amazing sponsors, 30% Club Canada, BDC, Lockheed Martin, Export Development Canada, and ADGA. So, JP, you once said, if you don't understand us, how are you going to work with us? Tell us about your current role at Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business.
Thanks for picking up on that. So I've been at the helm for about 7+ years now. The organization is over 35 years old. Really, our whole mission is to create space for Indigenous and non-Indigenous business communities to come together to proliferate in the world of commerce to build a stronger Indigenous economy. We do that through our programs, our events, and our research. And it's been an incredible 7+ years. It's been an incredible journey for myself personally as well.
So you shared with me just before we started to tape that you were recently at the Indigenous Women's Leadership Summit in Vancouver, and you had a unique experience as the only man in the room. Tell us about that experience.
Well, many of the women that were in there were friends of mine and colleagues, and myself being a recovering entrepreneur myself, it's amazing to see these incredible women journeying out into entrepreneurship. And on the second day, I was the only male in the room, about 250 women. The conference is, it's a second annual, started by a mother-daughter team, Lori and Nicole Sterrett. And it was an incredible experience. And at one point, I was actually, we're having these stand up and energize moments where our facilitator, she was asking us all to stand up, grab our butts, and then grab our breasts. And I'm like, I'm in it. I'm doing it. This is great. I'm having a lot of fun. And but at one point, you know, I did feel a slight unease, and because I was the only male in the room. And then I confided into the hosts, and we had a really great conversation. So this is how women, I'm sure many women feel when they're in many of these male-dominated rooms. And it was actually a really great experience to feel that.
So you have said that business isn't foreign to First Nations, as you like to say. They've just been on a forced hiatus for a very long time. Mm-hmm. In my TEDx talk that I did a while ago, I spoke about how everyone has their own superpowers, smartphone, wallet, and our values. And by making smart strategic buying decisions, you can transform communities mm-hmm. and create the world we want. Is this what you mean when you talk about economic reconciliation?
Yeah, if we start with a vision of what that actually looks like when we're there and then kind of reverse engineer that. We've been managing poverty for a very, very long time. And it really does sadden me because we are Canada's first entrepreneurs. We had these incredible trade routes. Even before the newcomers came, between our nations, we traded all the time, up and down Turtle Island, which is known as North America. And we had technology. We had strong work ethic. We had our fights as well. But at the end of the day, we had a commerce of living, true, you know, very strong commerce between nations, and so we've been on this forced hiatus. So back to that idea, well, if we're looking at economic reconciliation, that means that our communities are managing wealth again, and in order to manage wealth, you need to generate wealth, and using the business lens to do that, you have to leverage your assets, which are your people, your land, and your innovation. So it's been an incredible journey. Our Indigenous communities and businesses are now contributing well over $30 billion a year to Canada's economy. But we at CCAB and others are estimating that, you know, by 2024, we'll be up in around $100 billion.
Wow.
And so it is a strong economy driven by strong business leaders, both Indigenous and non, coming to the table to form these relationships.
Lots of partnerships and collaboration going on too, which I think is exciting.
It is. It is. You can't do this alone. There are many... The natural resource sector really has been at the forefront of much of these relationships. As Indigenous people, we are all over the landscape. And when natural resource projects want to get started, whether that's oil, gas, mining, forestry, renewable energies, what have you, they're going to be in the territories of our communities. So fortunately, unfortunately, the natural resource sector companies have been the ones that have been intersecting with our communities for a very long time. And at the start, it was very much... Keep the Indians on the reserves. They really don't belong in our economy. The government put them there for a reason. And then as we began to build our economic strength, our political strength, our legal strength through courts, etc., they were forced to come to the table to recognize our rights, recognize that we didn't just fade away into the sunset, that we are here and we need to thrive. And an economy through its wage economy, through the SMEs, is in which way we're going to do that. So they started to figure out pathways forward with us, and I think that's been basically the start, I think, of many of these relationships. And now we're seeing it proliferate in other parts of the economy. Over half of our population is now in urban centers, and so now there are incredible chefs, there are engineering firms, there are architectural firms, there are printing and media and. You name it. We're a shout out to Jen Harper, who's, you know, Cheekbone Beauty. She's producing this amazing lipstick line that she's exporting around the world. So we are just coming back. We are resurging as Canada's powerhouse, quite frankly, and it's growing by leaps and bounds.
So in our last national study on women entrepreneurs, which we released in 2018, we looked at women entrepreneurs and innovation, and we took a special look at Indigenous women entrepreneurs. Very inspiring, to your point. Jen Harper was somebody that we spoke to, and so many other amazing Indigenous women entrepreneurs. But boy, they had some additional challenges.
Mm-hmm. You know, those challenges, as an Indigenous person in this country, first of all, is you're combating bias, both conscious and unconscious. You're battling the Indian Act. As it's, you know, I can't get a mortgage for a home on my reserve.
Right.
I have a pretty decent job and I sit on a couple of cool boards, but I can't get a loan to a mortgage to build on my home because I can't own anything on reserve. You can't hold anything, you can't develop collateral on a reserve. So if you're an entrepreneur and you're trying to start a business, you need collateral to do it, or you're borrowing from aunts and uncles and mums and dads and friends to get your initial startup. And then that's exacerbated if you're a woman. I mean, I don't have to tell you about the challenges that women face as entrepreneurs, as people in general. But we're starting to see those barriers break down. There are many women that are succeeding on and off reserve. There are legal instruments to use, such as the First Nation Land Management Act, that is helping communities at least leverage some of the land. But women definitely, if you think of Indigenous as one barrier, and then being an Indigenous woman, that's an additional barrier.
Yeah, it was incredible. But the resilience of the Indigenous women entrepreneurs was incredibly inspiring.
They are. They are. You think about them as, we think about them as our fire keepers. We generally are a matriarchal society. And then the Indian Act came in, and of course it was dominated, you know, the people that were writing this act were white men from foreign countries that didn't understand how our cultural makeup was, how our governance systems worked. And we would have our chiefs, but women were very much the decision makers in our communities. And that line, that matriarchal line, has sort of been fractured a little bit. But now we're starting to see many women chief coming to the forefront, counselors, you know, a shout out to one of my friends out on the West Coast, Crystal Smith, Chief Crystal Smith, who's doing, you know, leading the LNG project, one of Canada's biggest projects in the country. And it's being led by an Indigenous woman with her community. So we find that, this is my only personal view, is, you know, I think when we put women into power, when we put them into the leadership positions, I think we advance our economy, we advance our relationships. I think we do it in a more careful way. I think it's just a more thoughtful way.
Mm-hmm. Hear, hear. I agree.
Yeah.
So speaking of a special woman, you once told me that two of your favorite things are your daughter and your boat. So, and in a picture you showed me, the two were together.
The two were together, so, both my babies. Yeah,
tell us more.
Well, my daughter is this incredible, she's almost 16. She's just hungry to go. As any teenage daughter will, she'll have an affront with me with regards to my career and business. But I know she just adores what I do. She adores the fact that, you know, I'm in a leadership position. I know she's proud of me. And, you know, she's, you see, I get overcomfortable about her. She's just this, I have this love for her. That's just, it's very difficult to describe. She hasn't had the easiest time. I mean, her mother and I split, about 6 years ago. But we still family vacation together. Her mom, Natasha, and I just had dinner. She made me dinner last night when I got into Ottawa. So we're still very, very close, but she's got a lot of love. She's incredibly creative and she wants to get into, makeup, design, mm-hmm. hair. And then she goes, well, Dad, how much do those people make? How much can a hair designer make? I said, well, I said in the city of Ottawa, I said, if you're really good, I don't know, $50,000-$70,000 a year. She goes, well, that's all right. And I said, but I think why not be an entrepreneur? Why not start your own studio and you can do design and run a business and be the boss kind of like you are already. And so she's, I don't know, but she's giving it some thought. But she's a great kid. I take her out hunting. I take her out fishing. I love how she transforms when she's on the land. And then she comes back into the city and she's into her friends and high school and doing all that other wonderful stuff, you know, young people do.
Yeah. Are you amused by trends like forest bathing? Does this seem like ridiculous to you? Because when you
forest bathing,
have you heard of that? You know, kind of being around, basically being on the land.
Oh, something that just comes naturally to some of us.
Exactly.
Well, I guess I'm probably just putting a new term to it to try to make it sound cool. But I can totally relate to forest bathing. I mean, as much time as I can possibly get, I spend on the land. Mm-hmm. I still hunt. You know, it's one of those things that I talk to people into Toronto about when they find out who I am and they go, oh, well, you know, what do you do? And then I tell them, you know, I can actually go out into the forest, harvest a moose, and right from that moment, I can do every step and put it on your plate and feed you. You know, I can field dress, I can butcher, and I can cook it, and I can make you a really nice meal. And I think that's, and not that I expect every Canadian to go out and harvest a tree, log a tree, or harvest an animal, or, you know, go out and get some grain and make some flour. But I think largely that there is this disconnect between the large urban centers and where our natural resources come from. I think that because of that disconnect, we're coming into a lot of, just, I guess if I could put a label on, a lot of ignorance, quite frankly, in the way that we debate, the way that our natural resources are developed in this country. I'm very blessed that I get to travel it all the time. You know, last time I saw you mm-hmm. was on a plane, mm-hmm. And that was a real treat. But I get to visit communities that are entrenched in natural resources, and it's when done right, I think it's a beautiful thing. But back to the point about forest bathing, call it whatever you want to call it, but do find ways to get into the natural environment because you'll appreciate more of what it can offer. But we can't also ignore the fact that it gives us the quality of life as Canadians as that we have today. Mm-hmm. So,
and what about water?
Oh, water. Is that an issue in this country? Oh my God. Water. Mm-hmm. Yeah, water is life. And we're very blessed in this country. My reserve is on Lake Nipigon. It's the biggest lake in Ontario, surrounded by the Ontario borders. It's 500 feet deep in parts. And we can still drink the water of the lake. And for that, I am grateful. In many parts of our country, the water is not drinkable. It's not fishable. And sometimes it's not even swimmable. We have to do better. When we talk about drinking water on reserves, it's amazing to see that the government has brought down the water boiler advisories from 100 plus down to, I think they're 50 or 60 now. That's obviously a great trend. But around these issues is we have to develop the capacity to continue to manage water. It's great that we should be protecting water, And when we do need to use water for natural resource projects, we need to do the best, use the best technology, use as little as possible to make sure that we safeguard our future resource. But we have to build the capacity. My fear is that in First Nation communities or northern communities, if we don't have the capacity to manage the water systems, they will fall down again. And so we need to make sure that we've got appropriate training and skills and education in place to make sure that we can manage our water resource, because it is absolutely fundamental.
So take me back to your 10-year-old self. Mm-hmm. What was that boy like? Where were you living? Mm. We know some of the things you were into, probably. So tell me more.
I can't disclose all because my parents might be listening. 10 years old, mm-hmm. I grew up in Thunder Bay. Mm-hmm. So just a little sidebar. My reserve was taken from us in 52 by the government and burnt to the ground. We just got the reserve back in 2009. So I grew up off reserve. Both my grandmothers were residential school survivors. So I was sort of removed from my community at the time. But at 10 years old, I was playing hockey. My dad would let me skip school. I wasn't a strong student. I'm sure just undiagnosed learning disabilities, but
nevertheless, you went on to get your MBA and like accolades and
work ethic. Yeah. I think work ethic got me through, and some good friends and family support. But at the age of 10, I was playing hockey. My dad would let me skip school if I was hunting or fishing. If that's the only reason I was allowed not to be in school. Tumultuous upbringing. You know, my dad was a logger. He wasn't always home. You know, it's tough because I see that in myself with my daughter. My parents went through a divorce. Same modeling, though. They get along just fine. And my mom and my stepmother get along well enough. But growing up, I knew I was a little bit different from the other kids because there's only my sister and one cousin and I in our grade school that had brown skin. Otherwise, it was mostly white. But I didn't feel ostracized. I knew I was First Nation, but I grew up away from the community for the most part. But I always spent my time weekends and summers with other community members out in the bush, which kept me connected. But I think I had a pretty normal childhood. I was very lucky. My dad was a logger and there was always food on the plate. My mom also worked and I had both parents that had jobs and it was really amazing modeling. And to that point, I was very lucky that my parents had a parent that had a job. So both my grandfathers were, one was a Frenchman, one was a Scotsman. One was a logger as well, like my dad. And the other one's a Trans-Canada pipeline worker, gas lines in Northern Ontario. And very fortunate they broke the cycle of dependency because, you know, my parents had a parent that had a job. And then I was very fortunate to have that modeling in front of me.
Yeah, the ripple effect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, JP, you've recently been appointed as the Chancellor of St. Paul's University College Waterloo. Tell us about that.
It's been a couple of years and it's been an extraordinary experience. I was incredibly humbled and unsure of why they were calling me to step up as their chancellor.
I'm not surprised.
Well, thank you. Chancellors aren't usually, I think I was 44 when they had asked me following Lord Axworthy. It's like, wow, what an honor. Mm-hmm. And so I accepted, of course. And one of the things that drew me to saying yes was that Richard Myers is just this really fantastic guy. He came from Algoma University as the principal over there in Sault Ste. Marie, which I attended some classes when I lived in Sault Ste. Marie. And Richard just came in with a very soft approach. And he's the principal of St. Paul's Waterloo. And and he says, you know, we're developing Canada's first Indigenous undergraduate business program, Bachelor of Commerce program. And would you like to be a part of that, essentially? And I was like, wow. You know, creating space for everybody by acknowledging the importance of an Indigenous approach to commerce and attracting Indigenous and non-Indigenous people to a program that is being developed now that is just going to add more depth and breadth to our economy or mm-hmm. that ecosystem.
Our nation as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I won't lie. It's kind of fun to put on that robe.
Does it come with a hat?
They offered the hat and I was like, no, it's going to mess my hairdo.
Well, it's a huge honor and very lucky to have you in that role.
Yeah, I'm very pleased. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, what's something you wish you knew earlier?
Financial literacy. Absolutely. And I think this is something we're afraid to talk about with each other, about money. Mm-hmm. And I think that's sometimes a struggle in many of our own indigenous communities about talking about money. Sometimes it's seen as for lack of a better term, evil. But money is just a form of commerce. It's how we trade. It's how we exchange. And planning for a future is really important. We need to understand. Like, I wish that I had the modeling where I knew what savings was at an earlier age. I knew, but unless your parents are practicing it, and you know, we didn't always have all the money in the world. That is for sure. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to teach my daughter about financial literacy, and now she's asking me questions about it. And I'm a little behind the game on the savings, but. Obviously in the last 10 years, been going really hard, but it's so important to start young, mm-hmm. so important to understand what compound interest is and all these things I didn't know about. And I think then that if your society starts to understand what financial literacy is, and especially from an Indigenous community perspective, then those leaders that come up through the ranks and begin to lead their communities or their community groups are the ones that are going to help indoctrinate others to understand what financial literacy is and how important it is to understand the economics of life. It
becomes a way of being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wish I knew that at a younger age.
So what's the last thing you've done that's really scared you?
Oh, the last thing that I've really, besides walking into that room with 250 women.
Yeah. One other one.
Let's see. Last summer, one of my staff took me and threw me out of a plane. It was a little.
Did you know that was coming?
I knew it was coming. Putting the parachute on kind of had a kind of signal to me. That definitely scared me a little bit. But as soon as I got up there, I felt at ease. I mean, I had the right people around me to make sure that I was going to be safe and have a.
I've never done that. I would have been scared. I don't think I'd be able. I would need someone probably to push me. Yeah. I think I'd probably.
Yeah, it was a little. I'm good. A little stiff. It's such a great question because I think we always have to be scaring ourselves mm-hmm. a little bit every day. And I scare myself by always entering into rooms that I don't know because I'm thrust into all these conversations all mm-hmm. the time, thrust into conversations about, you know, some pretty intimidating conversations mm-hmm. that I'm expected to at least have some understanding as a national Indigenous leader. And you never know where the conversation's going to go. You don't know where the room's going to go. I do 50 plus speaking engagements a year.
But you also speak internationally. I know the last year around this time, we were both speaking together at a conference mm-hmm. at Queen's.
At Queen's, that's right.
Yeah, you're on the road speaking everywhere.
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
And so what about tips? How do you figure out how to read the room? How do you... get yourself ready, you know, for people, for aspiring public speakers that would love to have the kind of presence and voice that you do.
I'm very lucky that I'm very empathetic and I can really read people, their energy and how they're feeling and relate to them. So the best way for me, so I know my storyline and every time it changes, depending on what the topic is. But I try to get into a room at least an hour or two prior, and I just talk to people. Mm-hmm. It eases me into the conversation. I'm not coming into it cold. I'm picking up on tidbits. The ability to, I think it's really important when you're relating to your audience that you relate to them authentically by making sure that you've talked to people, and then you draw them into the conversation. I spoke to so-and-so earlier, and this is the conversation we had, and you bring that into your storyline. People love stories. So tell as many stories as you can throughout and get the information through, of course. And the biggest piece of advice, and it's true, people remember a small percentage of what you say, but they're going to remember how you made them feel mm-hmm. and make people feel like they matter, make people feel like they're important because they are.
Mm-hmm. So. Absolutely. You've been a champion of women's leadership. So what's your advice for ambitious women who want to get ahead? What's that? Your unique perspective on this?
Be brave, be bold. When the organization that I'm so lucky to run, CCAB, I started with 7 staff, now we're over 30. And you've got to stand up for women. As men, we have to. It's important. And I'm very blessed to have this amazing woman that's coming in the ranks, CCAB, Tabitha Bull. She's my second in command, and I thrust her out as much as I possibly can. As much as she'll take, I'll give it to her. And she earns it, and she just does it. She's doing amazing things all the time, and I'm getting these incredible compliments about how amazing she is. And I advocate for all the time. Mm-hmm. Now that's just the man's perspective. And I can only imagine the challenges that women face all the time. And on building on the being brave, being bold, always throwing yourself into those uncomfortable situations. And I'm sure there's plenty of opportunity to do that. Mm-hmm. But have your mentors, women and men, have your downtime. It's so important. My downtime is forest washing in the forest,
bathing.
Forest bathing. And I guess, you know, just having that downtime to recharge yourself, I think is really important. Women are hard workers. Just do it.
Mm-hmm. So has your leadership style evolved over the years? And if so, how?
That's a great question. Absolutely it has. I think just with anything, as you become more confident in yourself, just because I keep throwing myself into situations that I have to stretch. And with that stretch also becomes an acknowledgement of accomplishment. And then when I look at the team that I'm so blessed to lead, putting them in places to push them, always checking in and make sure that they're comfortable enough, but not too comfortable, and pushing them. And, you know, when you start to build an amazing team around you, you kind of give them a target and they go and they just check in once in a while. And then you get the other team members to support each other. I've become a little more hands off with the team, mm-hmm. As I've
kind
built.
Get out of their way.
Get out of the way. Saying you hire people smarter than yourself. Mm-hmm. That's the way it's been done at CCAB. There's an extraordinary team. But the other thing too is from one of the most uncomfortable feeling, I suppose, is stepping into a boardroom, especially like Ontario Power Generation. Yeah. I remember my first board meeting 4 years ago, and there's 14 board members, all the executive of this major Ontario corporation. Mm-hmm. And I took the ICE Institute for Corporate Directors, mm-hmm. director training,
yeah,
through Ottman's.
Yeah.
And how important that was,
yes.
to kind of help ground you. Mm-hmm.
And a great network too.
Incredible network. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's great to have friends. But that I found really, obviously CCAB is a very small fraction of the size of OPG, but the learnings that I was able to take between both organizations, mm-hmm. I think has really helped me evolve as a leader.
And they need that other perspective too.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Like you need the diverse thoughts around the table. I mean, we know this.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm always advocating.
The research is clear.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. Always advocating for Indigenous people and women on boards. Mm-hmm. And I'm proud of OPG. We've come a long way and there's more women on our board. It was so interesting. We were doing interviews and it was amazing. I've got Wendy and Annie, governance, and the chair of OPG is a woman, and she's amazing. I look up to her. I've already said you're like a mentor to me. I mm-hmm. really look up to you. And we're interviewing people for our board, and two women and an Indigenous guy interviewing white men. It's a lot of fun,
picture.
It's a different picture, and it's a much needed picture. Mm-hmm. You know, that diversity is
crucial. I so agree. You'll be amused to know that in 1992, my first graduate degree in Canadian studies, I wrote on women on boards, mm-hmm. in 1992. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you nobody was thinking about it at that time. Now, change has been slow, certainly, but I'm excited when I hear the examples of Ontario Power Generation, that it looks and feels differently in 2019.
It does. It does. And as you rarely see Indigenous people on boards, mm-hmm. and we're nowhere near, like if we had to set a target, we're commensurate with our population of 5%. A board should have 5% representation, whatever that looks like. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't have to tell you how mm-hmm. important that is, but it's a signal to
all stakeholders.
Yeah, absolutely.
That you value it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. And so when you think about women, because you're very well networked and you are on all kinds of boards, what advice do you have for women that want to get the attention, for example, of the nominating committees? How would you advise women who, they might have already done their ICD and they're ready to go? What's your advice?
Have your champions that are already on boards that are going to champion for you. One of the reasons why I got on the OPG board is I had this amazing woman, you might have heard of her, Roberta Jameson. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Roberta Jameson.
Yeah.
I know. And she was advocating for me, and I had a couple other people advocating for me. Continue to do good work, because your good work will be recognized over your time. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to approach the headhunters, the organizations that actually look for people like you. Get in front of them. Just introduce yourself, be bold. put yourself in front of them so that you can be seen. If you're not seen, it's harder
to... You can't be known.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. That's great advice.
And then I guess lastly is volunteer boards. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a great... I volunteered on, and I still do.
Me too.
Volunteer boards are a great way to cut your teeth. It shows your commitment. It shows your interest. And just keep plugging away.
And you learn.
Oh my gosh, so much learning.
And a great network too.
Some of my biggest.
As well as feel good stuff.
Absolutely. And yeah. Couple of my biggest mistakes were sitting on boards. And luckily I had a good board to kind of correct me. But, mm-hmm. You'd be afraid. No, don't be afraid to put yourself out there.
Mm-hmm. Agree. Yeah. JP, can you tell me about the moose hide that you're wearing? There's a powerful story attached to it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. So the Moose Hide campaign was started by this amazing young woman, Raven Lissert, with the support of her dad, Paul. And they were hunting on the Highway of Tears. She's First Nation from BC. And of course, you know, being an Indigenous woman from BC or Indigenous from BC, you've had family members that have gone missing or murdered. And, you know, she thought to herself, what can I do as a young Indigenous woman to make a difference in the world? And so they took that first moose that she harvested, they tanned it, and they cut it up to little squares to raise awareness. And the Moose Hide campaign was born. And essentially, it's when you wear it, and mostly men wear it, but women too, it's your commitment to protect and honor all women and girls, well, specifically in recognition of Indigenous women and girls. And it's just such a powerful symbol. And anybody can go to moosehidecampaign.com and donate. And basically, they send you the placards with the little moose hide squares, and you can wear them. And it creates a conversation. And that's what we need to at least start to address this serious issue in this country.
Mm-hmm. So final question.
Sure.
And this is the biggie.
Uh-oh.
What's your dream for Canada?
Oh, we all talk about diversity and inclusion. I think given who I am and the work that I'm so blessed to do is that Indigenous people we don't need a CCAB. We don't need these, capital corporations that are only looking at Indigenous people, that we've got Indigenous people integrated throughout our communities leading business, and within corporations leading business, that we've got a $100+ billion economy, and that our people are thriving. So when we talk about economic reconciliation, that our people are actually managing wealth, because it is no fun managing poverty.
That's a beautiful dream for Canada. Mm. JP Gladue, Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business. He's the president and CEO, influential thinker and inspiring leader. So thank you so much for being on the Fearless Women podcast today.
Thank you, Janice.
Thanks for listening. We want our community to grow. Tell your friends, follow us on Instagram, and sign up for our newsletter at fearlesswomenpodcast.com to get the early scoop. Thanks again to our amazing sponsors, 30% Club Canada, BDC, Lockheed Martin, Export Development Canada, and ADCA. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite app. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star rating. I'm Janice McDonald. Stay fearless. Thank you to the 30% Club Canada for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. The 30% Club believes that gender balance on boards and in senior management not only encourages better leadership and governance, but diversity further contributes to better all-around board performance, and ultimately increased corporate performance for both companies and their shareholders. Want to learn more? Visit their website, 30percentclub.org, and select the Canada chapter to find out about membership, supporters, and key resources. Thank you to BDC, the bank devoted exclusively to entrepreneurs, for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. We love smart companies that want to amplify women's voices. For more information, go to bdc.ca/women.